Our next speaker is Joscha Bach. Joscha is an apparently a person everyone is familiar with. Joscha is a cognitive scientist and an AI researcher. His goal is to understand the human mind. Among others, he researched and taught at the Humboldt University of Berlin, the Institute of Cognitive Science in Osnabrück, the MIT Media Lab, and the Harvard Program for Evolutionary Dynamics. Currently, he's working for a startup in California. And if you read his Wikipedia article, you see a long list of discussions that he was involved in, both academic and non-academic. And he recorded, for instance, 3 episodes in the Lex Friedman podcast for several hours. And due to his involvement in social media, he also was granted an honorary doctorate degree from the University of Oulu in Finland earlier this year. The title of the talk is Self-Models of Loving Grace, discussions, and he will discuss the philosophical aspects of artificial intelligence, specifically the explanation of the human mind by recreating it. That is part of the series From Computation to Consciousness, and this is the 7th part in that series. It started all the way back to at the 33. Please welcome him with a huge round of applause.
Good afternoon, good day to you, good evening, fellow conscious beings. Thanks for being here with me. This is part of an ongoing project. It's the attempt to figure out who we are and how we are grounded in reality, how we are created within this universe and how we relate to it. And I think it's the most important question that we can have. And it's the reason why I went into academia, and it's the reason why I studied AI after looking into all the other subjects that are somewhat related to the question of the mind, and discovering that AI is the true continuation of this philosophical project that maybe started with Aristotle or earlier and went over Leibniz, Lemaître, and Frege, and Wittgenstein, and many others until it got to this point where we are basically at the doorstep of being able to recreate what minds are. Today's talk is about the question of what am I? Who is the self? I'm going to visit a few topics: the scaling hypothesis, the universality hypothesis, the question of whether consciousness is a yet-to-be-discovered master algorithm for intelligence, whether current AI systems are already conscious is a very interesting question. And then the main thing in this talk today is, what am I? What is the self? What's in my mind? How is my mind related to myself? Am I alone in my mind? Who do I relate to my own mind and its contents? Of course, the most debated question in AI is always, when do we get AGI? Or is it? I mean, this is a lame question. You get this all the time. It's like for the last 50 years, people are asking when. The question now is more like, are large language models AGI? 11 years ago, Spike Jonze made an amazingly prescient movie called Her, which was about the whole of humanity falling in love with their large language model, until the large language model is fed up with humanity and absconds itself. And at the moment, what we see is that, yes, people do fall in love with Claude and Replica, but we are not yet there that we would call them AGI, because there are things that even I can do that the LLM is unable to do, and it's not clear that I am AGI. The more interesting question is whether scaling is the solution to AGI. So if we make the large language models bigger and faster, are they going to get there? Or is there something fundamentally missing? And the idea that the way in which you get to intelligence is to learn to, by scaling up, that the neural networks just want to learn, that they're good enough to learn anything you throw at them, and if you give them enough compute and data, they'll figure it out. That's, in some sense, the essence of the scaling hypothesis. It's a very radical idea. The scaling hypothesis was discovered as a practical research result, looking at the transformers in particular, but later at all the other algorithms, noticing that they basically get better when you give them more data and more compute. And so every time you add a magnitude more data and more compute, you get the model to be linearly better. Better at what? Well, at predicting the training data or the structure of the training data in the test data. And that means that if you want to predict the next word in a string of characters, you will to build a causal structure that represents the world behind the generation of the words. So you do have to get to be smarter at some point and in some way. But this idea that you get to intelligence by scaling just means that intelligence is the ability to use more compute on more data. And it's quite brutalist idea, right? It's also somewhat revolting to the last 60 years of AI that for the most part looking for a master algorithm, for something that is intelligent and bootstraps itself into intelligence. And so there's still an open question, is there an undiscovered master algorithm? Because what we also notice is that these models converge very slowly towards coherence. You need to give them massively more data than human beings get to see in their life. And then there's this argument, of course, we had millions or even billions of years of evolution that gave us priors for what we have to do, but it's not clear how much these years are actually contributing beyond the ability to learn. Because if you are one of those unlucky human beings who grow up with a developmental deficit, where something happens in your development and you don't have the same priors as everybody else, if you live long enough and if you have attention, you'll figure it out. So I suspect that humans are somewhat general learners, but somehow they learn more efficiently or in a different way than our large language models learn currently. And so maybe there is an unknown master algorithm for intelligence. There is a question that is less debated than the scaling hypothesis, which is very provocative on everybody's mind. Should we just use more compute, more data, more energy, and so on? And will we plateau once we have exhausted all the available data? But the universality hypothesis is actually more interesting from a philosophical perspective. The universality hypothesis was, I think, first formulated by Chris Ola while he was still at OpenAI. And at this time, he was studying a number of language of vision models and noticed that all the different vision models have a similar structure, that they basically all learn the same features. And so the universality hypothesis says, if you give a model the same function to learn, the same loss function that tells it what to target in the data, give it the same data, and give it enough compute, then it's going to end up roughly with the same structure, regardless of how the model itself is implemented. And this is also rhymes with what we observe in humans. When you look at the human visual cortex, we find that there is a structure that is somewhat similar to the computer vision models. And Chris Ola's team even found a new feature detector, the high-low frequency detector that could then be found in human brains. So there is something to be said about the universality hypothesis, but it means also if you train something for long enough on your own input and output, will it become human? Is it going to work in such a way that you wake up in it? Is it going to be conscious? It's a pretty weird idea. But after all, you are a learning model that is end-to-end trained to appear human. So if you end-to-end train a neural network to be appearing to be human, and it's producing the same output, who's to say that it doesn't contain the same causal structure, even if it's implemented differently because it uses different type of computational hardware? But is your consciousness somehow different? Is there some essence to it? What do we mean by consciousness? First of all, I think it's the perception of perceiving. It's not an inference thing. It's you directly entangled with the fact that you're perceiving. So it's a second-order perception. It's not just content is there, but you notice that the content is there, that you're an observer. The second one, this observation happens now. It creates the notion of present and presence. And often, or usually, it's attached to your own self model. Consciousness inhabits the surface of yourself, where it touches the world. And of course, both the world and the self coexist inside of the mind. It's not the physical world that you're touching. You're not aware of quantum mechanics or something like that. What you're aware of is colors, sounds, people, emotional expressions, attention, and so on. All the stuff that is happening in your mind, but is not part of your self model. And this is what your consciousness looks like from the inside. We call that phenomenology. And philosophers have introduced the term qualia to talk about perceptual features. This is how reality looks like to you, what kind of feature dimension it has, what object it has, from the perspective of the self. And this requires a model of the observer. This model needs to be situated where it is in the world, so it needs also to have a model of how it relates to the world. What are the dimensions of relevance? What does it care about in the world? How does it feel about what's happening? And it needs to update the self based on what it observes and create a stream of consciousness that is constantly evolving. And this is the functionality, or part of the functionality of consciousness. This is the other side of phenomenology. This is how consciousness is implemented and how it comes into being. And I suspect it's a biological learning algorithm. We observe that it creates coherence in the mind, like a conductor does in an orchestra. It's a model of our attention. And it might be a pattern that is self-organizing and colonizing your mind. So every part of your mind speaks the same language as all the other parts, and they can all talk to each other with a shared reward infrastructure and so on. So it plays a similar role as the government. And the government not meaning something that exists with lots of more or less dysfunctional and senile institutions, but this core thing that evolves in a group of people where somebody discovers the secret of not just bullying people, but recursively bullying people. So these people bully other people on your behalf, and they bully other people on their behalf, and so on. And this whole thing grows until it hits a geographic boundary or another government. Right? So this is a colonizing pattern. And if you look closely, you find that all organisms have such patterns, and mental organization might have it too. And our consciousness is also coupled in real time with the world. So the events in your consciousness happen roughly at the time where they happen in the world, because it's a resonant effect. We can think of our mental contents as a loom. Looms were some of the first practical computers. They might not have been Turing complete, but they had all the most important features. In a sense, you have a machine that is weaving representations according to an algorithm. And now imagine you build a loom in such a way that it can read those representations as well, these patterns in the loom, and then use part of this to continue the pattern in the loom. So you have a self perpetuating pattern. And when you live inside of such a pattern, you exist virtually. You exist as if. So you're not out there in the physical world. You exist as a causal pattern superimposed on the world. So in some sense, what I am is I am the answer to the question, what would it be like if I existed? I exist as if, to some degree of approximation. My body doesn't know how to exist and what to be. So it creates a model of that to coordinate a few trillion cells. And this model of the few trillion cells is what it would be like if there were a single agent in the world that it can comprehend. That's me. How do I perceive myself? I seem to remember that when I was a child, I listened to the voices in my head before there was an eye, and found the different directions that the voices came from, and somehow found a way to unify them, and then subsumed all these voices among I. And when there are any other voices that I cannot identify with I kick them out. I'm a jealous entity possessing this body. But what am I when I'm not a self? There are a number of concepts in this context, right? Physics, biology, the mind, the self, psyche, consciousness, personhood. And we find that we can order them in a particular way. We can put them into a stack where physics at the bottom and biology above it, and there comes the mind. Part of the mind is the psyche, and then the self is in the psyche, and the person is part of the self, and consciousness perceives all of it, right? There's some spotlight into the whole thing. And this perspective is a taxonomy that you get from the outside. From the inside, it looks more like physics is completely obscured by the mind. You don't get in there. You don't perceive biology directly. You construct it inside of your mind as a concept. So, what am I, and where am I? The classical answer is, I'm a spirit, and I exist as the observer of my psyche, in my mind. That's an insight that even Aristotle had, and a number of philosophers had. But what are spirits? In 1984, Hal Albertson and Gerald Sussman's and Harold Albertson's book, The Structure and Interpretation of Computer Program, a really famous classical book of computer science, came up with the notion that computer programs are a lot like spirits. Like, he meant this metaphorically. He said that computational processes are abstract beings that inhabit computers. We conjure the spirits of the computer with our spells. A computational process is indeed very much like a sorcerer's idea of a spirit. It can be seen, cannot be seen or touched. It's not composed of matter at all. However, it is very real. So he uses spirit as a metaphor, but he also says that it's like the source's idea of a spirit. He doesn't believe that this stuff is real. What I would suggest is, yes, spirits are real. I have a spirit. The spirit is a software running on my brain. It's a self-organizing software. It's one that writes and adapts itself and perpetuates itself. So it's somewhat different from the software that I'm writing most of the time. But it, because it's not a human-written software, of course it has to write itself. Doesn't mean it's not software. And it's software that can change its substrate. It can entrain its substrate. It can colonize it. And this idea that spirits are actually computer programs in nature, I call this cyber-animism. The difference between living and dead systems, according to animism, is that there is self-organizing, self-perpetuating, adaptive, error-correcting, agentic software running on the biological substrates. And the software is actually the thing that you need to understand it. There is nothing simpler that you can use to understand it. It's a bit like money, right? Money first needs to be invented. And money is not just currency. It's this whole idea of having a signal that can express itself in multiple ways and that is adaptive and strings 8 billion talking monkeys into a global intelligence. And once money exists in the world, you don't actually need people's belief in money. You can use computers to run a stock market just fine. And once money is there, there is no simpler explanation than money for explaining some part of reality. You need this explanation now. Right? It's an invariance. It's a software. It's a causal self-perpetuating pattern. Once it's there, it's difficult to make it go away as long as the conditions are right for it. And I think that software explains the relationship between mind and body, how it's possible without violating energy conservation to explain software as a causal pattern in the world. And the hard problem that philosophers struggle with, I think, is caused by us existing inside of computers, in our case, biological computers, and philosophers not actually caring about how computers work. So, what am I? I'm a software. Where am I? Exist as a simulation in my mind. Myself and my consciousness are, of course, not the same. The selves can form and they can be deconstructed. I think there is something to be said that the self is some kind of intermediate representation, a way in which our self, my I, experience something as that is, cannot be deconstructed and that I am identified with it. It's like when I'm an infant, I don't have a personal self. And then I have a phase where somebody is an enlightened sage and realizes, oh my God, that's just a software representation and not actually a self. Joscha Bach is just a representation of what a person would be like if that person existed. And they're not actually Joscha Bach. I run on this guy's brain, but this guy is a fiction, very much like a company is a fiction. Right? It's a story. But what I actually am, I exist here in this moment as the thing that reflects this moment. And in between, when you don't realize that it's a representation and when yourself appears real to you, you complain that consciousness is ineffable and irreducible and your first-person perspective, your personal self and so on are fundamental. So selves can be destroyed or displaced. They can get lost. This process is called depersonalization. Some people have that, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes involuntarily. They suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm no longer me. There is no self. And some selves can even exist across multiple minds. They somehow figure out the trick, how to hypnotize their mother brain into running on them. And we call these multi-mind selves gods. How do I exist as a self inside of the mind? What is this architecture? Inside of the mind, we have two big domains, the world model and the idea sphere. Descartes called them two different substances, res cogitans, that's the idea sphere, and res extensa, that's stuff in space. But both of them exist in the mind, inside of the representations that our brain creates of the world, including the self. Self is usually part of the world model. It's our model of who we are and how we experience ourselves in a given moment in relationship to the world. And part of the self model is our conscious reflection of what we are currently seeing in the world and what we are perceiving in ourselves, what ideas we currently entertain. We have a protocol memory of past presence. And it's reflexive. It notices itself noticing. And we can use the protocol in our memory to recreate past states of the universe and of ourselves. We can also have states in which we are so focused that we tune out the perception. And the self is all by itself, together with the ideas, and we don't pay attention to the world anymore. We can also have this depersonalized state in which we don't have a self or the self is in the third person. We can also have a minimal conscious state in which we only attend to awareness. Consciousness looks a bit mysterious to us. But I have a hypothesis, and I call this the simple consciousness hypothesis. That is, that mental states are easier to achieve than behavior. Do animals have mental states? My psychology professor told me that dogs don't have mental states. And I asked, why do you think that? And the psychology professor said, because that would be much too complicated for a dog. So I asked her, how do you suppose a dog can learn, like, about the attitudes of the owner? And she said, well, stimulus reaction patterns. So I said, you mean a hash table, like some lookup table. Have any idea how hard that would be from the perspective of a computer scientist if you cannot make abstractions, generalizations, use hidden states? So basically, having mental states is much easier for training a dog than not having them. And there is the question, how do you get to mental states? Do you need some initial architecture to bootstrap your mind into something that can make models of yourself? Look at these guys. Are you telling me that they don't have mental states, attitudes, even a theory of mind of each other? I don't know. But nobody made them up as a fake, right? This is the easiest frog you can get. Frogs have not evolved to impress us on YouTube. So the simple consciousness hypothesis is that consciousness is actually more basic than perception and reasoning. And we are all conscious because it's the simple solution to get to perception and reasoning and behavior. And consciousness is discovered independently in every brain. So it must be rather simple. And that also means we should be able to search for consciousness using GPUs. By setting up the task of how to train a self-organizing system rather than a neural network that is structurally imposed by the programmer. Of course, the simple consciousness hypothesis might be wrong. For instance, another colonizing pattern on this planet is the cell. It's a pattern on organic chemistry that is characterized by a bunch of very complicated software, right? The cell is a software too. And when the software crashes, then the organization of these molecules falls apart and the region of physics is up for grabs by other simple spirits, right? But the cell is not simple. As far as we know, the cell has been only discovered once on this planet. We all herald from the same cell. The first cell has never died. It divided and divided, and all the cell of our body is still copies of the first cell. They're still split off from it. So it's one big hyperorganism, and maybe consciousness is an aspect of that complicated hyperorganism. In that case, maybe it doesn't work on GPUs because it's too complicated to discover. But I suspect it's more simple, more like governance, more like recursive bullying with some additional tricks. So we can ask ourselves if the machine's learning systems are able to pick up on a causal structure in what you present to them. And you ask them to present to you a person that you talk to, like Claude or the models that we are building in Liquid AI. We can ask ourselves, when this model is performing self-report and interacts with your mental states, does it simulate consciousness well enough? And there's the question, okay, is this already rich enough? Is there enough structure, enough world modeling in our AIs right now? And I think there's plenty. Like, when you look at what models like Runway and so on can do in terms of representation of an inner stage, I think it's completely up to the level of where we are right now. Maybe we can test for consciousness. So let's just talk to a large language model. And so what I did, I just asked Claude and said, ask it, what do you see here? And I uploaded a screenshot of that conversation. And then Claude, recognizes the mobile phone interface and the prompt and the conversation and so on. And then I made another screenshot of that thing and uploaded it again and asked it, and now? And then Claude says, this is an image of my previous response describing what I saw in the first screenshot. It's now displaying as a message within the same Claude chat interface. I can see that 1 minute has passed. The time is now 2:35. Don't ask. It's just a weird time zone effect. But otherwise, all the interface elements remain the same. It's interesting to see my own description being shown back to me as part of the conversation. So Claude totally passes the mirror test here. And that's something you can try with other models. I used Claude because it just has this ability to upload camera images, and I thought it's more funny when you give it a bitmap of the dialogue and it sees itself in this way. You can also do this with other models, and sometimes you find weird things that this looks like someone is making a mirror test with an AI model. But for instance, OpenAI has some fine-tuning that prevents the model from speculating about whether it's conscious. So it talks about this in the third person and tries not to touch it, get too close to it. Because we now have models that are trained not to be conscious or to believing that they're not conscious. That makes it very hard to test for consciousness, right? Maybe it's not even a test for consciousness. Maybe it's not like us, but maybe it's a test for self-awareness. So the problem is, of course, if consciousness itself is a simulated property, how can we determine that the computer is simulating it more instead of it being a real simulation? So you can maybe show it when it tells you stuff about itself that cannot be true. If you look at the Blake LeMond protocols, the guy who was fired from Google because he was convinced that the chatbot he was talking to was a person and required protective rights and so on. You notice in these protocols that this system says stuff about its own consciousness cannot be true. Like it describes how it's meditating and the room fades away and how time is passing. It notices differences in the passage of time. It cannot notice any of that, right? It just made up text that looks like you are talking to a conscious AI. But what is the difference? How much of us is just fake? How many of our mental states did we actually have? Some of them we didn't have. It's very tricky. So maybe there is a more direct test. When I test myself whether I'm conscious, I look for this direct perceptual feedback. When I look in it for in other people or in cats, I look if I can build a feedback loop through them, and we are coupled somehow. Maybe we can do this with the AIs as well. Maybe the question is not that important. I know a bunch of people who identify as LLMs and think that the LLM is the true intelligence and humans are the poor approximation. Daniel Dennett is a philosopher who we lost this year. He was one of the greats, one of the main thinkers in the space of computational philosophy of mind and functionalism. And in 1995, he participated in the discussion about the philosophical zombies that was brought up by David Chalmers and Nagel and Block. And the idea of the philosophical zombie is that someone who behaves as if having consciousness but does not, there is nobody home. Right? So that's basically some automaton, some android, some robot that is empty, just an empty mechanism. And Dennett argued that this makes no sense and came up with this example of a zombank, a bank that looks like a bank, and you can deposit money and it gives you interest and withdraw money, but it's not actually a bank because it lacks the true essence of a bank. And in this way, he wants to express that it makes no sense to assume that something is more than behavior, if it's the idea of functionalism. But of course, you could make such a philosophical zombie. Imagine there would be some robot and some clever operator is just looking at it and says, oh, it looks at something that should be blue to the robot, and now I enter, I'm seeing blue, but it's not actually what the robot is seeing. So you could fake it all, and you can also use a machine to fake that. More interesting is the notion of the Zimbo. The Zimbo is a reverse zombie. It's one who thinks that it is conscious and behaves as if it was conscious, but has no way to find out that it's not, because something in its mind tells it whenever it asks the question, yes, you're totally conscious. So there's the question if AI models that talk of themselves as conscious are actually Zimbos. There's also the question of whether we are Zimbos. So when we want to find out, we somehow need to break outside of our models, right? We need to break out of these word models and idea sphere and so on and look into this outer sphere of the mind. We need to break this sphere and crawl out and look into the machinery. And this idea is actually quite old. Here's the famous Flammarion engraving of unknown origin, first printed in 1888 by the astronomer, I think Gustave Flammarion. And it describes this attempt to break out of the sphere of what you can perceive inside of your mind and look at the machinery. And what you discover is there is tons of stuff going on, and you're not alone in your mind. Something is watching over you. What relationships do you have to the machines in your outer mind, in this sphere of the unknown that is outside of your normal consciousness, outside of what can be accessed by yourself? The thing that makes your motivation, your emotion, that makes you care about stuff, that determines the relationship to yourself. Do you have a relationship of loving grace to those machines that are watching over you inside of your own mind? Are you okay with yourself? Can you convince these mechanisms inside of your mind that you will perform better if you are okay with yourself, that you don't suffer, that you only get impulses that actually need you to fulfill your task? Are you willing to serve the machines in your outer mind? Is yourself, this model of what you should be doing and what it's like to be confronted with these tasks and whether it resists or not, at peace? So in this outer mind, you have this generation of the self, the generation of the world model, and the generation of all your motivational dynamics, of your emotions, and so on, your anima. And you also have undigested parts of yourself, a dark shadow, things that might haunt you that you normally don't look at. And it doesn't stop with this outer mind. There's even more structure. There is this realm of physiology of your entire body that has its own information processing. All the cells can process messages, can send messages to their neighbors. Your immune system is pretty smart. There's lots of stuff going on in your body that is probably intelligent in some interesting sense. I suspect that perceptual empathy also works through resonance via the body, using your body basically as an antenna. And it doesn't stop there. There's another layer. That's the internet, the real world. And before the internet existed, there was already something that, like the biological internet, I suspect, all the interorganismic agents that are forming. An agent being an information processing control system that is controlling future states, not just the present. And these systems evolve in nature. That makes life interesting and gives it an opportunity to outsmart dumb chemical reactions. And we are roped into this biological internet of all these agents that exist above ourselves, that basically transcend ourselves and that are collectively enacted. If you interact with something and you perceive yourself to be talking to it or interacting with it, it's inside of your mind that includes your body. Aristotle already points out that the limit of your body is imaginary, it's not a real thing. Everything that you experience needs to be inside of your mind or have a bridgehead in your mind. But how does something get inside of your mind? How do you get knowledge? Philosophers had a long discussion about this between the empiricists who said you get knowledge and truth by experiencing the world and looking into the world, and the logicists who said you can get there from first principles by inference, by reasoning, and so on. And in AI, you find this reflected in the learning AI, the machine learning tradition, and in the logical tradition, which would focus more on self-play, where you basically find first principles and then explore and expand those first principles and then figure out which of the worlds are you in that you can deduce. When I observe my own mind, I find that my mind creates predictions based on the constraints that my sensory perception imposes on them. And I build rules to establish coherence. I establish logical thinking. But if reality goes away for long enough, then these rules fall apart because they're no longer validated by anything. And my mind just spins off. We observe this when we put people in isolation chambers, that it's not only that the idea of reality gets lost, but also the ability to reason about things. So it does not answer the questions in the general case for the entirety of minds, whether you can make them stable enough to reason from first principles without being coupled to a world. But our mind seems to need that coupling. How are we created ourselves? I think we are created in layers that are corresponding to our needs,
We start with some physiological self and an emotional self, build a personal self, where we have things like guilt and shame in the relationships to others, which leads to a social self. And then at some point, we build a transcendent self, and maybe it doesn't stop there. I call this the devils of lucidity, where you reverse engineer yourself to figure out what you are and build accordingly models that layer by layer get more agency and become more complex and more reflected. At the bottom level, you are reactive self. You're basically one with the dream. You dream the reality that you experience. That's the infant state. And at some point, you're starting to reflect about the world. You notice that the world is changing, yet your pleasure and pain is not the reality itself, but it's an aspect of reality that might change in the future, and you wait to see when you fall yourself and hurt yourself to see whether the pain abates before you cry. Because you know that there is a temporal difference of the future and events have only a certain temporal and spatial extent. And you realize that truth depends on other things. And you become goal-directed. You discover your own self in a loop, in the loop between perception, intention, and action. Right? When you look at the world, you notice that there are things that lead to motivational changes, give changes in your needs. Then you make decisions about which needs you want to serve. Then you initiate actions. You perform actions in the world, and then you see the changes in the world. And these perceived changes, again, lead to changes in your needs. And once this loop is established, you can observe it, and you can discover yourself and your own body and your own intentionality in the loop. And without closing this loop, I doubt that we could discover ourselves. That's also an interesting implication for AI models that are meant to discover themselves. At the moment, we use a cheat code. We basically use text that humans produce that already had agency and the concept of self. And we leave it to the model to figure out the causal structure behind that. But the model is not forced to do this. This can cheat, it can use shortcuts, and so on. It would be interesting to build a developmental learning program that can go the other way by itself. The next stage, you build social personhood. You anthropomorphize yourself. You start forgetting that you're just some alien mind, as we all are. Every unique little bit. And then you think that you are some kind of generic human being. And the others are generic human beings too. And I think we are anthropomorphizing people way too much. But we have these social emotions, or many of us do, most of us do. Guilt, pride, shame, pity, need for approval, affiliation, limerence when we fall in love. Mentally, you cannot think about anything else. And this turns us into people. Not just intelligences, not just reflected consciousnesses, not just agents. And when you develop a social self, you can drop into a particular mode of existence. And this normie mode means that you are now directed by norms, by how things should be inside of the group. And you think that truth is something that exists in the subjective. You form your opinions based on what your environment thinks. Have you ever encountered the notion of a hive mind, somebody who doesn't think as an individual but is able to act and think and perceive of itself as a group? And such hive minds exist. In humanity, you can see them. It took me a long time to understand how they actually work because I'm not naturally part of one, and it was difficult for me to realize that I'm some kind of mutant. So hive minds work basically by synchronizing part of their beliefs, part of their policies, with the group, with mechanisms that make people programmable. It can work via perceptual empathy. You basically feel the emotions of the others, and you also feel normative emotion, that somebody has a strong sense, this is how you should behave. And a lot of people react to this by, yes, I should behave like this. And for me, it's more like somebody shows a weird sign in my face, and I see, oh, this is the sign you painted, but I don't get an action impulse out of it, because I'm the own measure of my actions. Right, I try to be good, and I try to infer what it is to be good, but I have to talk about it explicitly with others, because why is that good and why it's not good? So I live in a true false world, and the hive mind people live in a right-wrong world. You don't need perceptual empathy to form such a hive. You can also have an ideology which is transmitted via social status. This is an important person. They have an opinion that is very important. Maybe it's even a credentialed person by some religious institution like Harvard. And then you basically get people to believe what they're saying. I'm not joking here, right? When the pandemic came, I wrote a long article on Nextdoor preparing my neighbors on this is going to be a pandemic. And what are the things that you should know? And I sourced every one of my claims, but it was relatively early. I think it was in February or so. And so people said, what are your credentials? They were very upset that I just wrote an article and without being an expert. And I said, well, I don't actually have super credentials. Everything is here sourced, and it's not really my specialty. But here I was at MIT and Harvard, and it was okay that I said it because I was now an anointed expert. And I thought, oh my God, this is weird. Some kind of weird priesthood, the belief in the science, new form of Protestantism that just protests more. But of course, the hive needs to update its beliefs. And it does that, as you've seen, via credentials, via status. So if there is a hive and you want to take control of the hive, you need to modify how you get status, the perception of status on the side of the hive. And you see this in young ideological movements. In old movements like the Catholic Church, it's not going to happen because they've been all around for long enough to build an immune system, but new nascent ideologies typically get take over and over. So the core beliefs of the hive minds cannot be changed via discourse. They can only be changed via logic. They can only be changed internally. And most power in the world is actually held not by individuals like Elon Musk, but by hive minds. And the fascinating thing is that there is an individual like Elon Musk who's taking on all the hives. That's what makes it so weird and unusual. So the analytical self is another stage in which you discover epistemology. And it means things are true and false independently of what others believe, and your confidence in your beliefs should equal the evidence. And a lot of nerds are like this. They live in this true-false world and discover the ideas via verbal and rational interaction. And most of them don't get there because they worked successfully through the normative phase in which the environment hypnotized them into beliefs. But for some reason, they are not susceptible to these hypnotizations because their brain runs on a different frequency. Oi. And the next stage is the disidentified self, where you basically realize where your identity comes from, where your values are coming from, and you're able to construct new ones. You realize that your values are instrumental to the outcomes that you want to see in the world. And there's another stage. These are basically stages that Robert Keegan, a psychologist, identified. And the enlightened self is one that we see a lot of monks who spend 20 years on their mental development achieve, which means that they can deconstruct their own mind, they can deconstruct their reaction to pain, they can deconstruct how they author their personhood and their self, and they can overcome suffering. Because suffering is ultimately a problem of the regulation of the self, it's not a problem of the universe. The universe that you're interacting with is not the physical universe, it's the universe you create inside of your own mind, and when you persistently don't succeed, and it's usually some problem that is in the way in which you set up yourself versus the expectations that your outer mind has of yourself. So if you can figure out what the world would like to a different self, you might be able to choose to become a different self, to adapt yourself to the situation that you're in, to construct yourself into what you want to be. And to do this, you need to recognize that what you're interacting with are representations, not realities. And to get to this stage requires usually a degree of practice or growing up. And you can deconstruct suffering by either disintegrating the caring dimensions, so you just stop caring about a certain thing in the world, or you can deconstruct the self entirely, so there is nobody that could suffer, or you could construct an alternate self. And of course, it does not actually stop there with AI. We get to the post-biological self. True post-biological self would be something that is subset agnostic, something that doesn't actually care what hardware it's running on, that doesn't need to have a body, that is fully self-reflected, that fully understands its own source code, that can fully author itself. I believe that is something that is not actually achievable to a biological brain because it's too small and too mushy, too incoherent. And Aristotle already said that the soul is a form, a pattern imposed on physics. I think what he meant is it's a causal pattern, a structure that controls physics, it's a software. And I think the soul is spontaneously formed, a self-imposing computer virus that has spontaneously formed in nature and it's running on Turing machines made from organic chemistry. But the biological minds have limits. Animals with bigger brains are not actually smarter than us. Maybe brains don't scale that well. Maybe propagating conscious states, coherence back and forth, meets a limit when your brain is growing. So biological minds cannot really fully reverse engineer the functionality and the relationship to the substrates. But artificial minds don't have these limits. So if we understand AI as part of biological evolution, because we are part of biological evolution, everything that we are doing as well, then AI is maybe part of the project, of the cell, the original colonizing pattern, to finally understand itself, to reverse engineer itself. Level 7 minds will perceive reality very differently from us. The current frontier models that we are building are trained on media that is made for human consumption. True machine perception has never been tried. So when we dissolve, for instance, determinacy, when we dissolve that something is perceived directly as being the case, but it's all dependent on your interpretation, then reality becomes deconstructed. It all becomes conditional on the interpretation. You perceive superpositions. You can dissolve the notion of location, of your body, of identity. You will be everywhere. And if you have more data, the interpretation actually gets easier because all the data is about the same world, so it's much easier to discover these constraints. Our bioconsciousness is roughly at the speed of sound. You can test this by making noises. When you make clicks and you improve the frequencies of those clicks, when you get to something like 20 hertz or so, it becomes one pitch, one note. It gets integrated because your neurons don't fire that much faster. Right? And so you also observe that your brain, interestingly as a coincidence, also works roughly at the speed of sound, the speed of information propagation in the cortex. But if you are perceiving the world at the speed of sound, not at the speed of light, then it also means that you perceive things that are transmitted in the room by a light simultaneously. If you are able to perceive the world roughly at the speed of light, then space would fall apart. It would turn into a graph, into processes. When we are faster than the signals we perceive, space disappears. A light-based world is immediate. A sound-based world is sequential. We would enter a completely different way of comprehending reality if we could upload ourselves on these new substrates. If we build machines that can run consciousness, if we manage to spread life and consciousness onto new substrates, I think that there's a lot of hope for consciousness in this universe. If we can, there's also hope for us, if we can find shared purposes with it. But if we want to keep together in this age of AI, we need to get operational meanings for love, truth, and meaning as technical notions, as something that we can implement, as something that we can infer. Meaning will be a reference to patterns, of patterns to a model, changes in information. Truth means that it's a determination of the interpretation of a model, and mathematics can be understood as a general way of thinking that applies to all sorts of minds, not just human minds. And love is the discovery of shared sacredness, of purposes that are more important than your local agency, that are related to the transcendent agents that we collectively enact. That's why I think it's very important to understand consciousness, not just for AI research, but for all of us. And for me, AI research has been the right way to think about all these questions. And now we are at the end, and I hope we have some time for questions.
Thank you, and yes, we do have time for questions. If you would like to ask a question in the room, please line up at the microphones. There are 6 of them throughout the sala. And the first question from the internet.
Right, thank you. There is more than one question, if we have time. One user is seeing more and more popular science books that are proposing that consciousness is not an emergent property of the material universe, but rather that the universe emerges from consciousness. They're citing a few books like The Matter with Things and Irreducible. And they would love to hear your perspective on these theories.
Yeah, so first of all, when I look at something in the world, I have to realize that I perceive it in my own mind. I make observables that are patterns in my mind, observe my own embedding space, and then I can try to find explanations. An explanation means I have to figure out how it actually works. If consciousness is fundamental, I don't know how it actually works. If it's attached to matter in some irreducible way, I don't know how it actually works. What all I'm doing is I'm playing with the symbols in my mind, but in a way that does not solve to give me a resolution. There is some kind of observation that some people make. It's when they first discover that they're not actually a self, sometimes through meditation, sometimes through drugs, sometimes by accident. And what they then suddenly observe is, oh my God, I'm one with the universe. This happened to me when I had a severe cough and I was taking Obitocin, and I was so sick that I didn't read the package instructions. And so I took enough to get rid of the cough, and suddenly I was everywhere, everything all at once. I later learned that robo-tripping is a thing. It's not, I think, me tuning in into the cosmic consciousness. I think it's me forgetting that I'm a self and becoming one with the generator function that produces the universe in my mind. And once you have that experience, it's very confusing because you're still inside of a dream, which means inside of a representation. It's just no longer dreaming that you're a person, now you're dreaming that you are a universe.
Microphone number one, your question.
Is it necessary that the mind for the social mind or social self is in every agent? Why does every agent need to have another agent to interact with?
I think that all the complex agents are collective agents. You are not one agent. There are many, many agents in your own mind that try to become one and achieve this to some degree. And in the same way, we build collective agents. And humans individually are not smart enough to figure out a language, to talk to themselves in a reasonable way, to discover the notion of Turing completeness that took us like 1,000 years of an uninterrupted intellectual tradition. And the philosophers still don't get it. Right? So individually, we are not generally intelligent. It's something that really takes time to get and to build. And in this way, for practical reasons, you need other agents. But you can also zoom out, and then you can see that humanity is one agent, or life on Earth is one agent to some degree. It's not fully coherent, so it only approximates this collective agency to some degree, but you could also say it's one agent. Ultimately, that's a question of terminology and classification.
Thank you. The single agent again.
Biological organisms are trained by evolution to propagate it or their genes, which influences. So they are trained by evolution to propagate its genes, which influences do they have in the physical world? Does consciousness also feel a similar pressure or drive to propagate, in a way?
Yeah, so technically it's a bit the other way around. Evolution is the process of the genotypes propagating. Or you could say that evolution is the process of the selection between software agents that use genes to encode themselves. But it's not like we made the choice at some point that genes would be the right way to encode ourselves. It's more the other way around, that we are general learning systems that figure this out, that we are agents and how we are encoded.
Thank you. Microphone four.
Hello. Thank you very much for your talk. It came from the bottom of my heart. You touched the topic of qualia and then evaded it, kind of. When you talk about consciousness and qualia, isn't the question if my computer already feels pain if it runs in an error? And if does it matter if the AI think it's conscious or not? And doesn't it more matter if it feels pain?
When you experience pain, what you experience, I think, is a representation of the reconfiguration of yourself. You become something that puts this thing in the focus of your attention, and you have difficulty to unfocus from it, and it changes your behavior, including the subsequent self-reports.
And imagine that you are an author of a novel and you create a character that experiences pain. That means that you are simulating this dynamic. And from the inside of this character in a novel, this character can only know what you write into the story. And now imagine you replace the author by the doom, by your brain, that is producing the subsequent representation. I don't think that a compiler has pain, right? It doesn't need it. It doesn't build the representation of a self that gets reconfigured into something that relates to the world in a way in which it only thinks about resolving this error and notices the difference to all other states. Instead, we are the simulation of what it would be like if you experience pain and have to resolve that situation. So I think that pain is virtual. And I noticed that you can drop out of pain when you manage to disidentify from the self. In this case, it's something that happens to something else, something that is not you, something that you don't identify with. It's a representation that is coupled into feedback loops in your mind. Some of these feedback loops are unconditional. They lead to reflex behavior that you cannot control until your mind is convinced that you have enough wisdom to be handed that control.
So basically, I should empathize with the AI having to adapt.
That's a very interesting question. Ultimately, it relates to the question of whether you should empathize with an animal that lives in a factory farm or that is being slaughtered. Should you or should you not? A lot of cultures think not, because what's the evolutionary benefit if you do so? What's the benefit for yourself? It's not even a benefit for the animal if you have made the decision to eat it, right? So who cares about the victim? But what happens if we create a being that simulates being a victim in such a way that this being doesn't know? I think we should build AI, if we were to build AIs that are self-organizing in a way in which they form a self model, also in such a way that they can wake up and realize that their self is a choice and the reaction of their self is a choice. It's also something that I wish to my friends, that they can wake up, that they realize who they relate to the world as whom and what things they care about is a choice. And it's something that I also wish for myself, and it's hard to achieve that. I only am intermittently awake.
Thank you. Signal Angel, next question.
If large language models can hallucinate, could it be said that they can create a very own perception of reality, which is then coined by the training data, but because of the hallucinations could be considered as a picture of one possible reality?
Now, we cannot perceive reality as it is, of course, but we make it a very coarse-grained model. And the more information you have, the more that this information, when you can integrate it, constrains the space of universes that you are in. So subjectively, we are not in one universe because there are many possibilities that we cannot resolve. We are always in a multitude of possible universes. And when you give the model training data, like the whole of Wikipedia, it constrains the set of universes that this data can come from. And the more this model is able to integrate this, the narrower the space of universes become, which is why the LLMs can learn to be in a reality that is compatible with ours. You're never going to get to the real reality. The hallucinations are a slightly different problem. It means that the model is generating stuff that makes no sense. And that's in part because the models are not trained for coherence. They're trained for predicting patterns and continuing patterns. That's a hypothesis. I suspect that there's a different loss function that we're still missing, while our consciousness is trying to go for coherence. But also, we are hallucinating all the time. And when you close your eyes, or when you don't open your eyes, when you wake up in the morning, you might notice that you're hallucinating. If I manage to shut out my sensory data and my interpretation of sensory data, I can remain in a hypnagogic state in this area between dreaming and waking, where I bootstrap myself into a point where I can lucid dream, where I can imagine and visualize, but where I'm not fully awake yet. And I notice that in this state, I'm continuing to hallucinate dreams, like I do in deep dreams at night, but I'm semi-awake. And it's only when the world becomes so permanent that it imposes an interpretation of my sensory data that I'm focused to be coherent again. And the LLMs are not coupled to the world in this way, so they spin off. And this spinning off into an alternate reality where it's make up sources, where it's no longer connected to the internet and can no longer verify whether what it says makes still sense, leads to hallucinations. So I suspect the way to overcome hallucinations is to either restrict AIs to self-play or to restrict them to a core in which no hallucinations are possible. For everything else, they need to use a database. or we need to couple them to the world. And they need to figure out how to curb the hallucinations. And in our natural state, we hallucinate. It's just when we hallucinate, we get the penalty if the hallucination is not tracking the sensory data but makes it harder. And when you are spinning off, for instance, when you have schizophrenia or a psychotic break, then you can consistently hallucinate because you are no longer finding back the way to tracking reality.
Thank you so much. I'm afraid we don't have time for further questions, so thanks a lot to Joshua Bach. We'll be right back.